Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Caldwell v. Barnes.
May it please the court, Mr. Gus Pappas will present argument that the petitioner has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, your honors, my name is Gus Pappas, and I represent the petitioner in this case, Harold Caldwell. Yesterday morning, I was talking to my daughter, and it's the first time I've come up here and argued before the Supreme Court, and I was telling her about it because she was asking me why I was leaving again. And I said, I'm going to go argue this case in front of the Texas Supreme Court, the highest court in the state of Texas. And she looked at me and she said, well, that's good, Dad, but I've got to go to school. So it seemed to put things in proper perspective, and of course, everything's relevant. This case is a very important case, at least in my opinion, because of the fact that it impacts the issue of due process and what is really meant by the issue of due process and how this court is going to draft judgments in this particular state. And whether or not it's going to tell Texas judges in this particular state that when a case is decided and a judgment is entered, whether or not something that can happen in another state is going to affect the validity of a judgment in the state. Now, there are three undeniable truths in this particular case that I think couch the entire argument. One is that my client was never served with process in this particular case way back in 1989. The second thing is that the entire case is couched on the fact that the respondent in this case and their agent of service filed a fraudulent affidavit which created service in this particular case and allowed the court down in Caldwell County to enter the
Can I ask you a question about the in the briefs, the respondent is characterized as the fraud piece. Was it really based on what the affidavit filed by the person who completed the service that I certified that I've served this person, and that's where that claim comes from?
Yes, it does.
I mean, is it a fair statement to say that the respondent didn't have personal knowledge that that was improper service, if that is the case?
Well, Justice, we're not necessarily making that allegation. We don't really know one way or the other. We have not made that allegation.
But is it true that the respondent didn't sign an affidavit that said I personally served this person?
That is true. Now, the second fact that I think, or the third fact rather, that I think is important to couch this entire argument is the fact that my client did not find out about this judgment until 2 years after the entry of the judgment. Some almost 23 months after the fact. And he only found out about it because of the fact that the judgment that was entered in Texas way back in 1989, December 6th to be exact, was domesticated in the state of Colorado and an enforcement proceeding at that point in time. Now, given those particular facts, there's a couple of issues that the trial court and the court of appeals fail to understand, which is why we're here today. And that is, first of all, that when my client attacked the entry of that judgment down here in Hidalgo County, South Texas, in 1993, to disavow and set aside that judgment, he did so without having any legal remedies, motion for the trial, appeal, or writ of error to attack him. So that left, under Texas law, he was left with only one remedy, and that was a bill of review.
Mr. Pappas, does the record reflect why Mr. Caldwell did not contest domestication of the Texas judgment in Colorado when it was first filed?
The record indicates by affidavit, Mr. Caldwell, in the summary judgment that we filed in the lower court, that he attempted to do so in open court at the first instance when he had the opportunity in Colorado, but the court at that point in time indicated to him that it was not a matter that it could take up. And quite frankly,
is there record proof of that? Is there affidavit proof? Is there any record of the Colorado, what he said in open court in Colorado, what the judge said as part of the summary judgment record in this case that's pending before us?
Other than the affidavit of my client at the summary judgment level in the state of Texas when the bill of review was filed, Your Honor, I don't think there's anything in this record.
And that affidavit does not reflect why he did what he did or did not do in Colorado at any point in time.
It only reflects that he indicated that he went to the court in open court and indicated in the Colorado domestication proceeding.
Right.
That he went and said, I was not served with process, and the court at that point in time, according to his affidavit and the summary judgment, indicated, I'm sorry, that's not a matter we can take up at this point in time.
Could we clarify that for me? Because I thought I had read several things indicating that the reason why he didn't contest it initially in Colorado and not for some time down the road is because he didn't know until he had the proof from the person who filed the affidavit that the guy who filed the affidavit, in fact, did not serve Mr. Caldwell.
Well, Justice Abbott, your question illustrates the real problem here, and that is that while he certainly did in open court say that he wasn't serving, he believed he couldn't do anything about it. The undeniable fact of Texas law and the law of the state of Colorado, interestingly enough, is that unless the judgment is void on its face, and there are several distinctions that the trial court and court of appeals fail to make, unless it is void on its face, you won't be able to collaterally attack it. And the reason is very clear. Is because this state, and certainly this court in 1969, the case of Akers versus Simpson, indicated that you cannot attack a judgment collaterally when it's not void on its face because the recitals in the judgment are given absolute verity. In other words, you can't bring in any extrinsic evidence to say that that judgment was void. A court can only look at the record. So consequently, while when he went to the court in Colorado and said in the court, hey, I can't contest this judgment, the court said simply we can't address it because the full faith and credit clause says that notwithstanding any errors or irregularities in the judgment, I have to give this full faith and credit unless it's void on its face.
Is there any document or any page reference in the record indicating at what point in time he did inform any court that the reason he was contesting jurisdiction is because he was not served, as opposed to saying that the service process guy, process server guy, didn't serve him?
Yeah, Your Honor, I think the probably the most well-illustrated portion is when he attacked it in Colorado under a 60B motion and the execution proceeding up there, and then also when a proceeding was filed down here in Texas in the trial court, which was, for all intents and purposes, a bill of review. Subsequently, the declaratory judgment action was filed by the respondent. We responded in kind, filed a counterclaim that alleged the bill of review element and set forth in Alexander versus Hagedorn, and then, of course, subsequently we filed the bill of review as they were all merged together. So at that point in time, we're looking at May of 1993, June of 1993 at that point in time. Which of course goes to the apparent law when you apply the law of the state of Texas to this particular case. What it says is that in order to file the bill of review, the only thing that you have to do is certainly you have to have a meritorious defense. That's a standard. Two, you will not have been able to bring your claim because of fraud, accident, and mistake of the other side. We have those two met because, as we know, in the case of Peralta versus Heights Medical Center that was taken up by the United States Supreme Court, they stated, and of course it was a Texas case, stated that when you have no service of process, then in those instances, not only do you not have to show a meritorious defense, but the other two elements are also done away with as well. Now that court's opinion was also stated in Dewey versus Texarkana as well. And certainly the various law review articles that have written about it have agreed that simply all that my client had to show was that he was not served with process and that summary judgment would have been proper. Now, the caveat to that, and certainly we would admit, is that if he had legal remedies, an appeal, motion for trial, a writ of error if it was appropriate, then at that point in time, then he would have been able to bring him. But as we go back to the previous fact, he did not find out about it until 2 years after the fact. At which point in time, what the trial court and the Court of Appeals failed to understand is we have a 4-year statute of limitations on bills of review. This court, of course, has certainly enunciated that fact in its case of Williams versus Belief with regard to 16.051 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. So what has happened is that under Texas law, because we found out when we did, we had 4 years to bring it from the date of finding out the judgment. We did so. And so consequently, there was a right under Texas law to bring this bill of review when we did. Now, what the opposing side, of course, argues, and their claim is it's twofold. One, you didn't bring it in time in Texas. And two, you waived it because of your failure to attack in Colorado. Now, those arguments are patently inaccurate on their face. First of all, This court has noted in the case of Harris v. Lowe, now I didn't address this particular issue, there's the case of Harris v. Lowe, which is the only case in this state on the issue of latches in its purest form, not latches with regard to whether or not you sought to seek these remedies, but latches just simply because of the passage of time. And that case said that when you are not served with process, that latches is not an applicable defense in a bill of review case.
What says that?
Harris v. Lowe, Your Honor. In fact, the head note is, doctrine of latches has no application to bill of review seeking to set aside prior judgment during the period after expiration of time for filing for motion of new trial. That's the only case that's ever discussed latches with regard to time. And the reason is very simple, is because we have a statute of limitations that gives you 4 years. And certainly this case is a perfect example of why. Because in this particular case, my client was prohibited, would not have been able to find out about not being able to serve a process because he couldn't prove it. He certainly couldn't have done anything in Colorado because there, the judgment was valid on its face. There was an affidavit on the record that said he was served. So Colorado had to give it absolute verity under the full faith and credit clause. Could have done nothing there. This court has also indicated that even when you look at the remedies that are available, they have to be adequate. They simply can't be a remedy, which is what the respondents are arguing. They're saying, well, you have this remedy up in Colorado. Why don't you take it? Well, in fact, it has to be an adequate remedy. This case in Tice versus City of Pasadena has indicated that it has to be an adequate remedy. Also, the case of Griffith versus Conrad out of the Dallas court in 1991 indicated the very same thing. In that particular case, the judgment debtor had a right and found out in time to bring a claim under the writ of error within 6 months of the date of the judgment. But unfortunately, the judgment, like in this case, was not void on its face. And so consequently, what happened was is that it said, this is not an adequate remedy, you must bring a bill of review. Which is exactly what's happened in this case. The fact that what we did going to Colorado, if we attacked it there or we didn't attack it there, is really irrelevant because of course we claim that we did, but nevertheless, even if we didn't, it would have not been an adequate remedy to attack the Texas default judgment because it wasn't void on its face.
What about the inequity to the other side, who apparently spent at least $275,000 in trying to pursue this?
Your Honor, first of all, I guess the top water bait argument to that is that, one, that's not an element of the bill of review claim. But secondly, if you study the cases on bills of review, in most every instance, there has been an execution. The debtor, the judgment debtor, doesn't find out until his property's been sold. Certainly in Peralta, that was the case. So what happens is in all of these instances, you've gone down the road pretty far. And consequently, what happens is that the courts have all indicated that, and certainly Josh Hodges out of the Texas Law Review indicated that what happens is you return it all the way back. You wipe the slate clean. Because the issues of due process are too important to overlook. So in that case, one, it's not a factor. However, when you talk about injustice, you must temper that with the idea that, first of all, it was the fault of their agent in filing a fraudulent affidavit that created this problem. And secondly, in this particular case, the execution has gone unfettered. So consequently, they have executed on properties over the last 4 or 5 years and have obtained a tremendous amount of income from the execution and, in fact, have satisfied their judgment through their execution proceedings because we were not able to file a supersedes bond because of the amount of this judgment, which is probably now $30 million. So, consequently, all the shareholders, all the people in the state of Colorado who had interest in this property have lost out as well. So when we talk about injustice, we have to temper it also with the fact that there's a whole slew of other people out there that have had a tremendous amount of injustice upon them. The Court of Appeals and the trial court just failed to understand something, and that is once you lose your remedy, latches simply does not apply to prohibit you from filing a bill of review from that point, just as Harris v. Lowe said, up to the time of your statute of limitations. This case illustrates why that's important. Secondly, when we went to Colorado, and this is their big argument, they said, you waived it. Well, The fact of the matter is that if you went to Colorado, it would have been an impermissible collateral attack. Simply couldn't have done anything about it. The court would have looked at it, said it's valid on its face. We can't do anything about it. And even if we could, it would have only affected the enforcement of that proceeding in Colorado. The Colorado State Supreme Court in Marworth versus McGuire, which is a case they heavily rely upon, indicates that even if we could do anything about it, if we could not affect the judgment down in Texas.
Now, Mr. Pappas, I'm probably reading this wrong, but from what I'm hearing, you're saying that the judgment could not have been collaterally attacked in Colorado.
That's correct.
And I'm looking at the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, and they say on page 11 that appellant could have collaterally attacked it in Colorado if it was, in fact, a void judgment or was based upon fraud.
Well, and Your Honor, that's where they made a mistake, because there's a distinction that has to be made that void versus void on its face versus voidable. They do not make that distinction, because you see, when a judgment, when we talk and you look through all of the cases of the United States Supreme Court and all the cases through this court and the courts of appeal, they all talk about when you don't have service of process, the judgment's void. They use it loosely. What they really mean is void on its face, because only then can a court in Colorado sitting simply say, well, it's void on its face on the record. We don't need any extrinsic evidence to determine that fact. But even in those instances, they could do nothing more than simply say it's not enforceable in this state. That's all. Because we know that the case of Marworth v. McGuire says we can't address what happened in the state of Texas. This court has also said that in the case of Montgomery versus Harvey, where it said this state cannot vacate the judgment of another state. So consequently, even if we had attacked it, even if it was void on its face, making all of those assumptions, of course, which are not the case, they still would have done nothing more than been able to stop the enforcement. The problem we have here, and the policy that would be created by their argument, which the respondents are judging the state, and I would say that the longer, the bigger policy issues here would be more in their interest. Your Honor, I see my time's up. May I finish my call?
You might finish the thing.
Is that if my client, which he may have property in every single state in this union, what their argument means is that he would have to go to every single state and to attack it as a precondition to being able to come back here to the state of Texas.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear all the arguments from response.
Please support Mr. Thomas Matlock with present arguments.
May it please the court. I'm Tom Matlock. I represent respondent Bob Barnes, but I'm not sure I'm here on the right case. Your Honor, Marworth against McGuire says square out in Colorado you can collaterally attack a judgment if the problem alleged is subject matter or personal jurisdiction. Period. That ends that issue. Second,
would the judgment in Texas still be valid?
Would the judgment in Texas still be valid? Yes, ma'am, it would be valid, but, and I'll address the point about his argument outside the record that execution was continued unfettered. Yes, the clear answer is yes. That would not affect the judgment in Texas, but it would stop execution in Colorado.
But it, could you answer his last argument that then the same judgment could be domesticated in any state where the defendant had property?
Of course it could. And that's exactly the point. How long can he sit on his hands and not come back to Texas and say, I was never served? That is precisely the point. We've got to have some point at which which judgments become final.
Well, there's a 4 years. Your Honor? There's a 4 year limitation statute for bill of review.
If a judgment is void, is void, is void, 4 years shouldn't apply. This court, I can't see a four-year statute cutting off due process rights unless there's some other overriding policy.
There is one, finality of judgments.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Well, but why, if there's a four-year statute, why should latches cut it off sooner?
It's not, if I may point out, it's not merely latches. Opposing counsel said that, and he cited the Harris against Lowe case, which seems to say that latches doesn't cut off your bill of review rights merely because of passage of time. But what we have here is not merely passive sitting on my hands waiting for the passage of time between September of 91 and May of 93 when he first raised the claim. What we have here is guns blazing, creditors' bill in equity, all out attempt to collect the judgment in Colorado. We spent, by affidavit, $275,000 worth of lawyer time on it. He spent, by affidavit, $300,000 worth of lawyer time fighting the creditors' bill in equity. And he acknowledges that he said, I was never served. He said it in open court. He acknowledged that he had that remedy, and yet instead of using his Colorado, instead of using the remedies available in Colorado to stop the execution, instead of coming back to Texas and filing his bill of review, he continued to fight the collection on the merits. He acknowledged the validity of that judgment.
And what did he have at that point in time to attack the judgment with? He didn't have proof that the affidavit in the file was fraudulent.
Well, I'm sorry, he could have so testified. Of course he had proof. He could have put himself under oath and said, I was never served. I mean, he says he had no proof.
But in a bill of review, doesn't it have to appear from the face of the record?
No, Your Honor. It has to be clear, but there would have been nothing to stop him from filing, for example, his he said he couldn't collaterally attack it in Texas, I mean in Colorado. He ultimately did by his Rule 60 motion. And what his excuse for waiting the 19 months is, I couldn't prove it. But there would have been nothing keeping him from putting forth his own testimony that I was never served. And it certainly makes common sense that the judge in Colorado would have abated those collection proceedings to give him time to muster his evidence. I mean, the bottom line is what he did in Colorado for 19 months was sit on his hands and wait until it was convenient for him, and frankly, until we were closing in on collecting on the judgment, until he formally raised the claim. Let me point out further that he never initiated any bill of review in Texas. We're here not on his bill of review, we're here on my request for declaratory judgment that by his conduct in Colorado, treating the judgment as valid, he waived his right to complain about the judgment in Texas. We have the timeline here, and this is in the record, if I may. This case, the underlying case, involves a loan. Barnes loaned Caldwell $1.25 million in January of 1986. He had previously made a smaller loan. The smaller one was rolling. This is all in the record. We are here on cause number 1558, filed in 4 of 89. Interlocutory default judgment, final default judgment, December of 89. We domesticated it in Colorado, September of 91. He was served in Colorado. He admits it. He had lawyers at that point.
Was in the bill of review and your suit or your file for the declaratory judgment a consolidated for trial?
They were, in fact, consolidated,
Your
Honor.
So we're here on both issues.
We're here on both of them. My point is, he never initiated any action in Texas. He chose to sit on his hands and not do anything. And let me point out,
well, on 9/29/93, by your timeline, Caldwell files equitable review.
Right. He finally filed a standalone equitable bill of review in Texas. But if you look at Caldwell's affidavit, the affidavit of Alan Hampson, the Colorado lawyer, you will see that there was, that this collection suit involved thousands of documents, court hearings, testimony, and once again, he acknowledged in court in Colorado, his affidavit is there, but my understanding is he did in fact say it. By the way, I was never served, and the judge in Colorado indicated, well, you can't do anything about it now.
Mr. Matlock, does this record show on its face now that it's undisputed that Mr. Caldwell was not served with the original Texas suit and that, in fact, the affidavit filed is not truthful?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, and I was going to address that. At best, what we have here is a Mr. Process Server Purdue, are you lying then? Were you lying then, or are you lying now? At best or worst, depending on one's point of view, it's a fact question whether or not he was served.
And that's the fact question is generated by the return of service showing that he did serve, and then what proof is there, and then an affidavit or other proof in which he produced saying he didn't. Where's our fact question?
Yes, but not quite, Your Honor. When we hired the process server, he sent back the standard Texas form, yes, I served him such and such a day, such and such a place. To use the currently fashionable phrase, if you parse his words in the affidavit that he filed saying that he didn't serve in Colorado, the later affidavit, it doesn't say, I never served Caldwell with the Texas papers. What it says is, I never served Caldwell with a summons and complaint. If you look at the original affidavit, it's a checklist, and it is typed on there that I served Caldwell with a complaint, excuse me, the whatever the Texas term is. It is correctly stated in the original affidavit, and it's typed on there and checked off. In his affidavit, by contrast, he does not say, I didn't serve him with citation and petition. What it says is, I didn't serve him with summons and complaint.
Well, this case is before us on the grant of a summary judgment.
Yes.
Correct, and the denial of your opponent's summary judgment.
Correct.
But we have a disputed fact issue in the case as to whether or not there was service originally in the lawsuit?
Yes. I have an affidavit from Purdue saying I did serve him. We got an affidavit from Caldwell and Purdue saying I didn't serve him. So it's a fact issue.
Well, if that's the case, why shouldn't all summary judgments be overturned?
Why shouldn't what?
All summary judgments be
ours
overruled.
Should not be overturned because the finding that Caldwell elected to treat the judgment as valid by his conduct in Colorado, choosing to fight the case on the collection on its merits, does not depend on whether or not he was served. If we look at, if I may, the restatement of judgments, all I'm asking the court to do is apply either the restatement of judgments or the third prong of Hagedorn.
Well, why don't we have a fact issue on whether or not he did accept the validity of the judgment, since Mr. Caldwell has filed an affidavit in which he says that he told the trial judge in Colorado in the domestication proceedings, I wasn't served and I want to contest, and the trial judge said no, because we do have affidavit proof on that. Why don't we have a fact issue on your waiver question?
Because he did avail himself of formal Colorado remedies. He under Colorado law, when he was first served with the domestication, that served, and Texas law is exactly the same, that is the same as the filing of a petition and the granting of a judgment at the same time. Under Colorado law, he had the opportunity to file a Rule 12b motion, same as federal, contesting jurisdiction. He had the ability under Colorado law to file a motion for new trial. He had the ability under Colorado law to appeal. He always had the ability under Colorado law to file a Rule 60B motion, which he ultimately did, and at any time he could, and in fact under rules of equity, should have come back to Texas and filed his bill of review.
So it's not really, it's actually litigating in the collection matter that you're saying constitutes the waiver. It's the fact that you did not pursue legal remedies to challenge the judgment collaterally in Colorado.
With due respect, it's both, Your Honor. We've got the passive concept outlined in Hagedorn. That is, one has to demonstrate that one was not guilty of lack of negligence or lack of diligence. But we also have a more active concept as set forth in the restatement of judgments that not only did he passively sit back and not do anything, he very clearly in Colorado chose to fight the collection on the merits when under circumstances that any reasonable person would have said, this is not a valid judgment.
Mr. Matlack, I know you're trying to collect on the judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
But what is the status of the original loan?
I'm sorry?
What is the status of the loan, the $1.25 million?
He didn't pay.
The date has not been paid.
To date, it's not been paid. Let me point out a couple of other things. They're outside the record, but he raised it, and I've got to point it out. He said that there's shareholders in Colorado with interest in this property that we've collected, that there's a lot of other people who have an interest in it. That is wrong, wrong, wrong.
That's not necessary for us to...
It's not. Okay, Your Honor.
I mean, if it is, then keep talking outside the record, I guess.
Well, I think it's kind of a...
But I don't think it is. That's really a Colorado court problem.
That's a Colorado court problem, but it's part of this poor Herald, poor shareholders. This person in Texas has taken advantage of this poor little gerbil in the land of the wolves. And Caldwell himself, I mean, I've been litigating with Caldwell, and this is in the record. First lawsuit that I filed against Mr. Caldwell on behalf of Judge Barnes was in 1985. I've only been a lawyer 23 years, and I've been fighting with him going on 14 of them. He is not a babe in the woods, and that is in the record. So the answer is the basic underlying lawsuit was because Caldwell has failed to pay the $1.25 million, which to this day...
But that became a $15 million default judgment?
Yes, ma'am. Well, it became a $15 million default judgment because he didn't pay the $1.25 million. He had his common law wife file a fraudulent suit in Cameron County to steal the collateral. Barnes had the property sold, the collateral sold contract for deed. He filed two fraudulent bankruptcies in Denver, Colorado, and this is on the record, which prevented the sale of the collateral. He forced Bob Barnes into bankruptcy. That's how we get to $15 million, Your Honor. It's not just the failure to pay the $1.25 million. It's the attempt to steal the collateral and the fraudulent filing of bankruptcy to prevent Bob from selling the collateral.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Judgments must at some point be accorded finality. And this is an absolutely perfect example on the facts of what can happen when judgments are not accorded finality.
Mr. Matlock, was Mr. Caldwell served with the original lawsuit?
Purdue, the process server, says he was. Purdue later comes back and says he wasn't served with summons and complaint. Mr. Caldwell is guilty of perjury, has been found guilty of perjury by the bankruptcy court. And the answer is, I believe he was. But there's no proof of it. Okay. What Caldwell did during this period of time was by his conduct mislead the litigants, that's us, the courts in Colorado in the collection case, the courts in Colorado in the condemnation case on some of the property referred to in Mr. Hampson's affidavit, and by his general conduct in fighting on the merits of the collection case, acknowledging in open court that he was making the claim that he was never served, and yet never formally availing himself of the myriad of remedies available to him. The 12D motion in Colorado he could have filed at the outset, the appeal, the motion for new trial, the ability to come back down here in Texas. Instead, he chose to fight the collection case on his merits. And I want to point out that to hold for Respondent Barnes in this case does not involve making new law. It doesn't involve writing on a blank tablet. All it involves is applying prong number 3 of the Alexander against Hagedorn test. That is, to that one who is asking for equity in an equitable bill of review must demonstrate that he himself is not guilty of lack of diligence in asking for equity.
The U.S. Supreme Court wasn't real impressed with that Alexander versus Hagedorn test.
In the Peralta case? All Peralta really, it doesn't have any, that's a smokescreen, if I may, Your Honor. Peralta doesn't have anything to do with this. Peralta says that if you don't, if service or jurisdiction, let me back up a little bit. Peralta involved a dead citation, a citation that was served more than 90 days later. And all Peralta says is, if it's a service or jurisdiction type issue, you don't have to allege a meritorious defense which you were prevented from arguing or raising by some wrongdoing of the other side. I have no doubt that any creative lawyer can create a meritorious defense and make a sufficient allegation that he was prevented from raising it by opposing, by the other side, to get over those first two prongs. Where he loses is that he demonstrated not only a lack, the passive concept, lacking diligence in attacking the underlying Texas judgment, but also by his conduct, he demonstrated affirmatively that he was choosing not to fight the merits of the judgment, but to fight collection. A couple of other points, if I may. Sooner or later, we do have litigants, society as a whole, courts, have to have some finality in judgments. If their argument is accepted, and they make it square out in their brief, if no service is the problem, then that argument can be raised at any time. You point out, Your Honor, that there's a 4-year statute. If it's void, 4 years should not do it. And the arguments are made, well, you can't breathe life into a void judgment. That's not what we're doing here. What we're doing here is saying that by your conduct, Mr. Caldwell, under these circumstances, both your passive conduct and your active conduct, you have so misled the litigants and the courts that, to use the old phrase in equity, it should not lie in your mouth to now say the judgment is invalid or I'm not subject to it.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Yes, sir.
Your Honors, a few things. First of all, the merits of this case have not been litigated. At no point in time has any testimony been taken on the merits of this particular case, the note or anything else. This was a default judgment. $15.5 million, quite frankly, came out of thin air. But in any event, the other thing is that what they would require my client to do, and we've also already established and they've admitted the fact that he came up in open court in Colorado and said, I wasn't served with process. And what did the judge say? He says, I'm sorry, I can't issue that, is require him to submit, and he said in his own testimony, extrinsic evidence, which this court and every court that has addressed that issue has said is impermissible when the judgment is not void on its face. And it wasn't here because you had the affidavit showing service. So what they're trying to say is that, well, notwithstanding all the law, And notwithstanding what you had to do in Texas or in Colorado, you still should have just gone out there, even though the court could have never considered and would have never accepted any extrinsic evidence. The best evidence is the fact that he brought the action. Moreover, as everybody's admitted here, the fact is that anything that had happened in Colorado still wouldn't have affected anything down here. This court needs to reverse this case, remand it back, reverse and render on our summary judgment, or alternatively say, was there service of process on it?
Well, is there a fact issue on the question of whether Caldwell was served?
Well, Your Honor, it's an interesting question because...
Well, I mean, if you can't, that makes a big difference in terms of the relief that you're requesting.
Well, Your Honor, it is our position, and we briefed that the fact that they did never attach the original affidavit by the process server to their motion for summary judgment, so therefore, under the law of state, the only thing that was in front of the court at the time he entered the summary judgment was our affidavits, and the affidavits of the several other people indicated there was no service of process. So we believe on that basis that summary judgment could be rendered in our favor. However, if you've got a fact issue, naturally it's got to be sent back. And if there's no service of process, the fact of the matter is this case needs to be reversed. That's exactly what Peralta said. And that's exactly because it said, it addressed the issue of meritorious defense and indicated that when there's no service of process, the second and third elements of Alexander versus Hagedorn need not be met. What we have here, when you look at the restatement that treat the judgment as valid, silence is not an issue. Of course, we have here that he did make the statement, but silence is not an issue. That does not make the judgment valid. Caldwell did what he could under the circumstances he had. That's why he has a four-year statute of limitations. What he's asking you to do is to say, no, there's no four-year statute of limitations. In this particular case, because we did find out within 4 years, we brought the claim within 4 years, it would certainly be a different question and a different case indeed if we found out after 4 years. But that's not the question we have before.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. The second call, the court will now take a brief